Section 4, The Maturing Colony. As you read, look for how the success of rice cultivation was tied to an increase of the slave population. The struggles between those favoring religious tolerance and those supporting an established church. The causes and effects of Indian uprisings. Successful actions against pirates. The gradual move from proprietary to royal government. Terms: Carolina Gold, Church Act of 1706, Board of Indian Commissioners. By the end of the 17th century, South Carolina was no longer just a tiny English community with barely a toehold on the coast of America. After 30 years, it had become a stable colony that had begun to develop some wealth for the free settlers, but not for the indentured servants or slaves or the proprietors in England. Its population had come to include migrants from several nations of Europe and slaves from diverse ethnic groups in Africa, and many of that diverse population had moved out into the lands, beckoning them far beyond Charlestown. The developing economy. By the early 18th century, South Carolina had found a staple crop, rice. The cultivation of rice was to dominate South Carolina's agriculture in the 18th century and share dominance in the 19th century with cotton. For nearly two centuries, Carolina Gold, the rice named for its gilded color when still in the husk, made the colony and then the state one of the wealthiest in the country, until the Civil War suddenly changed all that. Rice, in many ways, set the destiny of South Carolina. First, it supported a small number of wealthy aristocrats who would dominate the colony's political and social life. Second, rice could be grown in abundance only on a limited amount of land beside rivers near the coast. That meant the Lowcountry would continue its control over South Carolina during the reign of rice. Third, the cultivation of rice ensured that the primary labor system would be black slavery. Slaves were an essential ingredient of the rice culture of South Carolina. Never could the planters have found indentured servants or free laborers who knew how to cultivate rice and were willing to do the incredibly hard labor involved. Free or soon-to-be-free indentured workers would not have endured the terrible working conditions in swamps plagued with alligators, water moccasins, and mosquitoes. Without slaves, their knowledge, and heavy labor, South Carolina would have been a much less prosperous place. Rice planters sought to import slaves from rice-producing areas of Africa, and the numbers from those areas grew dramatically in the 1700s. Perhaps slaves were the ones who brought the first seeds to Carolina in the 1690s. Nobody knows. Legend has it that the first seeds were brought to the colony from Madagascar, off the east coast of Africa, by a sea captain and given to the man who seemed to be everywhere, Dr. Henry Woodward. South Carolina began exporting rice by 1700, sending out over 268,000 pounds per year. Production increased sharply in the coming decades, as did the number of slaves. By 1730, South Carolina was approaching 20 million pounds of rice exported per year. The total number of slaves in the colony was over 21,000 in 1730, almost double the number of whites and Indians combined. The number of slaves and the amount of rice produced would increase almost continuously until the Civil War. For nearly two centuries after 1700, the coastal zone of South Carolina was to be the leading rice-producing region of North America. While the production of rice was climbing to dominance, the older sources of income continued to be important. The trade of skins, furs, and slaves with the Indians remained profitable. The Indian hunters were ranging farther west to supply the European demands for animal hides, and the production of naval stores continued to be very profitable for many Carolinians. Religious controversies. the proprietor's promise of religious freedom was not easily achieved. Toleration of religious beliefs different from theirs was not a habit yet adopted by most Europeans. The generally accepted view was that within one nation there could be only one religion, or else chaos would result. But the proprietors were businessmen trying to sell people on moving to Carolina to develop a profit-making operation for themselves. They used a carrot, freedom, to attract dissenters to their colony, while the English government used a stick, persecution, to push them out of England. British monarchs were happy to have a safety valve in America to which these troublemakers could migrate. The first church buildings. In the first decade, Charlestown had no church buildings and no regular ministers. Most of the settlers were Anglicans, mostly from Barbados. In the new Charlestown at Oyster Point, a building lot was set aside in 1680 for an Anglican church, and soon the first St. Philip's was built. Later in the decade, dissenter groups built a whitewashed place of worship called the White Meeting House on what came to be called Meeting Street. For several decades, the various religious groups in the colony got along rather well, though there was considerable prejudice against the Huguenots. Not only were they not Anglican, but they also spoke French, and England was at war with France often after 1690. An established church. The relative harmony collapsed after 1700, when a hard-line Anglican and hard-nosed Goose Creek man, James Moore, became governor. Moore was succeeded by Nathaniel Johnson, another staunch Anglican. This set the stage for Anglicans to make a power move to take over the colony's government, despite the fact that dissenters composed over half the white population and held a majority in the Commons House of Assembly. Governor Johnson called a special session of the Assembly in 1704, but neglected to inform most of the dissenter delegates in time. The Anglican representatives who met passed a requirement that to serve in the Assembly a person had to be an Anglican. Later in 1704, the Assembly, without dissenter representation, proclaimed the Anglican Church the official established church of South Carolina. That meant public tax money would be used to build Anglican churches and pay Anglican clergymen. Dissenters would have to pay taxes for a church they would not attend, plus make voluntary contributions to support their own churches. Their appeal to the proprietors to veto the legislation was denied. However, the English House of Lords, the highest court of appeals, overruled the law. The Church Act of 1706. Back in Charlestown, the Commons House went to work on a compromise. The Church Act of 1706, with some later additions, was very important for the future of South Carolina religion and politics. Dissenters were allowed to vote and hold government office and practice their religion freely, but the Anglican Church was to be the established church of the colony. It remained so until the American Revolution. The government maintained detailed control over church activities. Separation of church and state was not yet a well-accepted idea. The colony was divided into parishes, Anglican church districts, which would be the basis of local government in the Low Country until after the Civil War. The parish leadership ran the local government, collected local taxes, built roads and bridges, and maintained law and order. It also took care of the poor and kept records of births, marriages, and deaths. With the Compromise Church Act of 1706, religious controversies tapered off, but even more menacing problems were on the horizon on the frontier. Indian Wars. Trade with the Indians was a mainstay in the Carolina economy from the beginning. Most of the problems that arose between Indians and white settlers at this time stemmed from white traders cheating and abusing the Native Americans. The Assembly created a Board of Indian Commissioners in 1707 to establish some order in the trade and force traders to treat Indians fairly. Despite the best efforts of the board and its Indian agent, Thomas Nairn, they could not get the trade under control. The greed was too great. The first major uprising was in North Carolina, where the Tuscarora rose up against the white traders and settlers in 1711 and 1712. South Carolina sent military expeditions and bore most of the financial burden to put down the revolt. The officers were white, but most of the fighters were of the Yamassee, Apalachee, Catawba, Wateree, Winya, and other tribes. They broke the Tuscarora Nation, and the few survivors fled north and merged with their Iroquois kinsmen. The most serious threat to South Carolina was from the Yamassee along the Savannah River and their allies, Creek, Choctaw, Apalachee, Saraw, Santee, Waccamaw, and some Cherokee. In spite of their helping against the Tuscarora, all felt they had been misused and cheated by the white traders who had gotten them into hopeless debt. Most Indian nations felt the pressure of the white population moving into their tribal lands. This Indian alliance was powerful enough to threaten the extermination of the European and African populations of South Carolina. When trouble seemed to be brewing, Nairn and two other agents went to meet with the Yemassee and calm them. Instead, the Yemassee killed the two agents, and Nairn died after days of torture. Next, the Yemassee began attacking plantations near Port Royal, killing 100 settlers and destroying buildings and livestock. Some settlers escaped on a ship. Whites from all along the coast hurried to Charlestown for protection. The governor armed and mobilized white men and even slaves in the defense effort. The attack on Charlestown did not come. The government persuaded the Cherokee to join them in the fight against the Creek, the largest tribe in the anti-white alliance. That turned the tide and probably saved the colony. Most of the fighting was over by 1716, but a treaty with the Creek formally ended the war in 1717. The Yemassee War was a major disaster for both sides. What was left of the Yemassee Nation straggled back to Florida, where they left only three decades earlier to escape the Spaniards and live near the friendlier English. The Creek and Cherokee stayed hostile to each other for decades. On the other side, about 400 settlers were killed. 90% of white traders were murdered by their Indian trading partners. Half the land under cultivation was abandoned in 1715 and 16, causing food shortages. Destruction of property was horrendous. The skin and fur trade did not get back to normal for several years. This expensive war drove the government at Charlestown into debt. Some Carolinians learned the lesson that poor treatment of their Indian neighbors could have very bad results. They all learned that in a crisis they could expect very little help from the other colonies, the British government, or the proprietors. Pirate Troubles. Since its beginning, South Carolina had maintained a sort of love-hate relationship with pirates. Carolinians approved of those enterprising English seamen who preyed on Spanish and French ships, and they loved the hard cash the pirates brought to Charlestown. The tolerance of pirates and the romance about these buccaneers stemmed partly from the blurring of lines between a pirate and a privateer. A privateer was a seaman licensed by a government to prey upon enemy shipping in wartime. A pirate was outside the law, operating on his own and attacking any nation's ships he chose. Many privateers were authorized by the British government during their war with France and Spain between 1702 and 1713. After the war, some of the privateers continued their plundering ways, this time even against English ships sailing in South Carolina waters. Carolinians did not look favorably on pirates attacking cargo ships headed to their port. The pirates were becoming a great problem as they grew more bold and threatening. In 1717, the notorious Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard, appeared outside Charlestown Harbor, trapping several ships and taking prisoners. He demanded medical supplies, or he would kill the prisoners, burn the ships, and lay waste to the town. The town sent the supplies, and Blackbeard sailed away. Governor Robert Johnson requested assistance against the pirates from the proprietors and the British government, but none came. When other pirates threatened in 1718, Johnson took responsibility himself and sent out a fleet under the command of William Rhett, an able soldier and seaman. Rhett managed to trap the romanticized gentleman pirate, Stede Bonnet, in the Cape Fear River in North Carolina. Bonnet was a well-educated and wealthy planter from Barbados, who entered a brief but dramatic life as a pirate captain. Rhett captured Bonnet's ship and hauled Bonnet and his crew back to Charlestown, where they met justice at the end of a rope. Another pirate, Richard Worley, threatened the town, and Governor Johnson himself sailed out with four vessels disguised as merchant ships and engaged him in battle. The pirates lost both their ships, and Worley was killed. Johnson brought the remaining pirates back to town for another series of hangings. Altogether, 49 pirates were hanged in Charlestown in 1 month near the end of 1718. This outburst of energetic law enforcement and self-protection did not totally end piracy in South Carolina waters, but it helped. By her actions against the pirates, South Carolina did a great service for all the English colonies. At the same time, it gave the colony the self-confidence for its challenge to the authority of the proprietors. The Revolution Against the Proprietors, 1719. Over the decades, many South Carolinians had come to the conclusion that the proprietors would never act in the colonists' best interest. The lack of support for South Carolina by the proprietors in the crises of the Yemassee War and the rash of pirate attacks eliminated all support of the proprietors among the colonists. Most Carolinians had decided that their lives and fortunes would be safer with Britain's King George I. The last straw was in 1719 when the proprietors vetoed 20 laws passed by the South Carolina Assembly. The Assembly rebelled and chose General James Moore as temporary governor. The militia, the only armed force in the colony, supported the new governor. The legal governor, Robert Johnson, backed down, and the revolutionaries were in control. It is important to note that these revolutionaries were not malcontents or desperate people from the bottom of society. They were the wealthy elite. Note also that they did not want independence from the king. They wanted his direct rule. Governor Moore and the Assembly petitioned King George I and the Board of Trade to remove the proprietors and appoint a new governor. They defended their bloodless revolution as being like the Glorious Revolution of 1688, English men defending their right to live only under laws to which they had consented. The Crown's response was slow to come. Nearly 2 years passed before a new provisional, temporary governor arrived, and nearly a decade passed before the transition to full royal control was complete. While waiting for a new governor to arrive from England, Governor Moore and the Assembly governed. The revolution by the Carolina elite was successful. South Carolina had passed another pivotal moment in her history. The decade of the 1720s. Governor Moore, the Council, and the Commons House of Assembly moved wisely to demonstrate they were in control and were reasonable men. They carefully explained all their actions to the government in London. They collected taxes, demonstrating that the people viewed them as the legitimate, legal and rightful government. They made changes in South Carolina's government to make it more like the royal governments of other colonies. But the decade of the 1720s was difficult. The economy of the colony was faltering. The royal government had halted its subsidy for naval stores, thus reducing the producers' profits. There were some bad crop years for rice. Many planters, having bought slaves on credit, began to fear bankruptcy. By the end of the decade, some rice planters were organizing to prevent collection of taxes. The proprietors continued efforts to reverse the revolution. They insisted they were the only ones who could grant or sell land, making land titles less certain. Finally, in 1729, the king bought out the proprietors and took over direct governance of South Carolina. It was to be a royal colony throughout the remainder of the colonial era. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form Carolina Gold, Church Act of 1706, Board of Indian Commissioners. 2. Why were slaves such an essential ingredient in the rice culture of South Carolina? 3. What was the difference between a privateer and a pirate? The following is a summary of Chapter 5. Although there had been some exploration of the Carolina area before 1670, that year marked the first permanent settlement in Carolina. England's King Charles II granted a large area of land to 8 lords proprietors, who were successful in establishing a settlement that came to be known as Charlestown. The earliest settlers came from England and Barbados, but settlers from other countries soon were drawn to the Carolina colony, giving it quite a diverse population. Indians and African slaves also left their mark on the culture of the colony that would become South Carolina. Trade with the local Indians, such as the Yemassee and the Westo, was very profitable for the Carolina settlers. Unfortunately, the white traders became quite greedy and cheated the Indians. This led to wars between the Indians and the settlers. Land ownership also presented problems for the settlers and the Indians because the views each held concerning ownership were very different. Carolina began as a proprietary colony that was governed by the Lord's proprietors through their appointed governor who lived in the colony. The settlers were unhappy with their situation under this type of government and petitioned King George I to remove proprietary rule and appoint a governor himself. They were ready to be under the king's direct rule, which finally happened in 1729 when South Carolina became a royal colony.